So Vince, you've got a really interesting, you're very similar to Scott, and you've got an interesting background, an interesting history in terms of commonality, just for the purposes of our audience. Would you mind just revisiting that over the next 60 seconds? And then we can get into the cultural history of the development of gin and rum and all of those things.
Yeah, great. I joined the Navy back in January 1987 as a sailor. I was promoted about 3 years after that into the ranks of the officer world. Had a really full and varied career, lots of time at sea in ships various, from the biggest to the smallest. Lucky enough to have visited every continent in the world in that time. Left after just coming up towards 26 years, having had I did a tour of duty in Iraq and other places as well. So, and then I went into the Merchant Navy, worked for Geestlein, the banana importers. They import, pretty much the largest number of bananas into the UK here in Portsmouth, where I am now. I worked for them for 5 years out in the Caribbean. Left there really to start my own. I had started a business called the Rum Club in 2015 with a friend of mine, he's also ex-Navy. And that was just buying rum that people couldn't get in the UK because I'm a massive rum nerd and love rum. And I got home on leave one time and finished my favorite bottle of rum, thought, must be able to buy this on the internet in the UK these days. Couldn't. So said to my buddy, let's set up a rum club, a little bit like the gin clubs that are here in the UK. So we did. It took off, didn't go mental, was never going to make us very rich, but it got us into the rum scene and the UK rum market. And all the while we would taste the rums, I would say to him, you know, obviously you have a few and get a little bit squiffy. And I would say, you know, at some point we've got to make our own rum, haven't we? And he would sort of say, yeah, yeah, whatever. Anyway, I engineered to be made redundant from Geestlein. And I turned to Giles and said, are we going to make this rum then? And he said, are you serious? And I said, as a heart attack. And the rest, as they say, is history. We now have a distillery in an 18th century bastion fort in the southeastern tip of Portsea Island in Portsmouth, where we make artisan gin and rum. We laid down most of our rum for aging, which is coming out next year, May, for our first three-year-old rum. So, very historical, because no one's ever made rum in Portsmouth before, and certainly no one's ever aged rum in Portsmouth before. So, yeah, it's a big, big year next year for us. That's about it, up to date-ish.
I love it. I love people who see a problem and actually have the, you know, the innate ability to go, I'm gonna do something about that and fix it, right? So that speaks near and dear to my heart. I love it. And for those of you who can't see Vince's background on the podcast here, he's sitting in front of about 9 big barrels of aging rum, and I'm completely jealous, and my mouth is watering as I'm looking at it. So that's pretty awesome. How did you find the transition out from the Navy? Because that's a hell of a career. And then transitioning out in the Navy and becoming, you know, not only just a civilian and a retiree, but, you know, or getting into the entrepreneurial space. How did you find that whole process?
I'll be entirely honest. I think the best word to use is accidental, as much as anything. I think, like everybody, when you've been in the service for as long as I had, there is a real, true element of fear when it comes to leaving. Probably the reason I was in the service for nearly 26 years was because of the fear of leaving. Because you get sort of past the tipping point, I think, where it becomes comfortable, the pay's good, the jobs are not as risky as they once were. You perhaps don't go away as often as you were, you know, and you can sit there. And, you know, a lot of people sit there and bob along until they leave and do little after that. But I always had this yearning to do something more. I didn't want to just do that. I didn't want to be Mr. Mediocre and finish. No disrespect to those who do it that way, but I didn't want to do it. And so I started to look for opportunities outside. They were all the opportunities that came to me, and I was headhunted by a few companies that were doing the Horn of Africa, you know, anti-piracy stuff, because my sort of specialism was surface warfare and also intelligence. So I had I could have very simply walked into a job, you know, running teams on merchant vessels on the Horn of Africa and the rest of the world, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't want to go from one military organization to a quasi-military organization, because what's the point, you know? And let's face it, East Africa is not the most pleasant part of the world to live in if you have to be over there a lot of the time, having been there a few times. So I was a bit worried, didn't know what to do, and I fell accidentally, and I use the word accidentally, deliberately, into the role in Eastline. Now, key point, and it's very important, and I always say this to people who are looking to leave the service, whichever service it is, you've got to be a bit cheeky. You've got to be a bit ballsy. You've got to understand that the people who want to employ you have no idea what you are and the skills that you have to bring. So if you see an advert that says, wah, 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 blah, 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 and all of it is above your head and you think, you know, well, I've never done that. I've never been this. I don't have that specific qualification. Cut it there and then. Finish that view straight away, because penny to a pinch of shit, within 6 months, you're going to be all over the job and doing it better than the person that you relieved. All right. So, and that's the first lesson I would say. So I looked at this job. It fell in my lap. It was to be superintendent cargo for Geestline. Right now, to explain what that is for people who don't know, superintendent cargo is it's a post master's job. So you've been a ship master, so a captain of a merchant vessel. So you have to have all those tickets that are involved in that. Now, Royal Navy has an equivalent, but it's not quite an equivalent. What I mean by that is I had the ticket in the Royal Navy to be able to drive any warship that the Navy had. So from carrier all the way down to little fella, that I was qualified to do that. So that's equivalent to whatever it is, 30,000 ton unlimited in the merchant Navy, right? But it's not equivalent because it's not properly ticked off and signed off as an equivalent qualification. And the main reason for that is cargo and the loading and distribution of. Now, way back when in Dartmouth, and I'm sure Angus did this as well, we learned or were taught about cargo, metacentric height, you know, stability, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. Well, I had to sort of hoist that all back in from the depths of my brain. And I went into this job. They gave me, they had the leap of faith, and they saw that they could see potential in someone that could pick up the role quite quickly and run with it. So I just bullied my way in, if you like, I suppose. I don't mean bully's the wrong word. It was a role that I knew I would be able to do, even though I had absolutely no idea what the role was. And I think it's really important that that's the sort of attitude you have, because if you don't have that attitude, then again, you'll just end up bobbing along, catching whatever somebody is, you know, will condescend to let you do. And if that's what you want to do for the rest of your life, that's fine. But that's not me. So transition for me was not particularly difficult. The other reason for that is I was long described in the Navy as the least military officer most people knew anyway. You know, not many XOs of a Type 42 destroyer would, you know, have an evening painting people's toenails in the wardroom, the officer's mess. You know, I'm not saying we did that all the time, but, you know, we had fun. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I, you know, I, it didn't have to be stiff and starchy. I was taught from a very young age as a midshipman by an incredibly sage and a professional naval officer that you should always conduct yourself with relaxed professionalism. And that's what I did.
Love it. There's so many things there to unpack, man. I'm going to go back a little bit and say, when you said fear and getting out, I see it all the time, right? And I try and tell, you know, I talk to, I'm a former special forces guy. And so I talk to, you know, people who are much higher in special operations community rank wise than I was. And they have the same fear alive and well. And I'm going, you've run a special forces battalion or group. You've literally had 1,000 special operators underneath you. The problem sets in dealing with that are nothing compared with the civilian world, right? You now have an HR person and all these other, you know, minions underneath you as an executive, but far too many of them are taking these roles. Either one, like you said, they go to a defense contracting company, just take off the uniform and still live by the rank and the job that they had before. And then they wonder why they're still getting divorces. Their kids aren't liking them and hanging out with them anymore. And it's because this whole promise of, you know, I'm going to do my time and then get out and be the family guy. It's all a lie. And nobody does that, right? And then the ones who truly are groundbreaking, and I'll be so bold as to say you're one of those who go into that next thing and you know, kind of Richard Branson it with the whole attitude of just say yes and figure it out later, right? I mean, you know, just get in there and go.
Yeah, I mean, I am unfortunately one of those divorce statistics, but that was, you know, that came more, I think, and this again is another salutary lesson because I've seen it many times, especially Navy, because we're away so much for long periods of time. If your relationship isn't as strong as you perhaps thought or perceived it to be, there will come a time, especially when you leave the service, where you will have to live together. And you've got to live together 24/7, right? Well, I left the Navy and went into a job where I was in the Caribbean, coming home and going away again. So again, I had a stay of execution, I guess, if you like. It was only when I finally came ashore and started living at home all the time that I unfortunately realized, like so many, that actually the dream of no longer going away, as you just said, and of becoming the family man, actually wasn't as easy and didn't come as naturally as perhaps I thought it might. And my relationship wasn't as strong as I thought it was. And unfortunately, you know, became a statistic. Now, am I upset about that? Well, I was at the time. But I guess now, you know, as I was saying earlier with Angus, you know, and he actually said, you know, marriage is another institution in the same way I'd left one, the service. And I guess I've left another one. And now I'm really free to flap my wings and you know, be that entrepreneur. That's not to say you can't be an entrepreneur without being a family man. I'm not saying that at all. But I think some of us probably, it's easier.
But you do have to know yourself, right? In a similar situation. I mean, my wife and I got married on our 6-month anniversary dating. And 2 weeks later, I was in basic training. And then for the next 13 years, and she'll tell you this, I'm not exaggerating at all. I was gone about 70 to 80% of our marriage in the kids' lives. I mean, and we still are happy. We're going on 20 years now and everything. But when I left service, you know, I left the teams and was a GS-13 and still traveling around and, you know, same thing, civilian clothes, but still a service job and for as a federal employee. And then we moved to Australia and I was still gone because my whole tasking with the Institute and more was doing U.S. business development. So I was back in the U.S. all the time. And I say all this for a reason, right? Because when I talk to entrepreneurs who are veterans who are transitioning, the very first question I ask them, and it kind of makes them take a step back, is what do you want to be and where do you want to be, right? Like, because they all kind of look at it, tend to look at it as, I want to be an executive with Microsoft. And I'm going, no, stop. That's bullshit, right? Like, you know, if you're already in that area, maybe geographically that might work out for you. But, you know, where do you want to be geographically and what do you want to be? And Angus will tell you now, I do run a company and it's growing more than I thought it was going to be a single person LLC, limited liability corporation. And now I've got a team of people and payroll to hit and all this stuff. And I love it, but I absolutely prioritize family first, you know, or over everything. And I don't miss any more soccer games. I don't miss any more, you know, date nights. I hate watching TV, but you know, we have a couple TV shows, and when they're on, I stop what I'm doing, put the laptop away, and watch a TV show with my wife and kids, you know, and everything else. And but it's a whole different thing, because when I'm doing that, even though I prioritize that, I still have to look at myself, and I'm jonesing on the inside and going, God, I should be updating the website. Man, I should be updating these PowerPoints. I should be doing all these other things, and just letting it go and knowing that, you know, this is what I wanted to be. That's even more troublesome to me half the time than just work, right? Work is easy, but far too often we all prioritize work and we get into this routine of normal, and then we don't realize that our definition of normal has become something different than we wanted it to become. It's not who we are and what we are. And I have to ask, where were you in the Caribbean? Because I lived in Dominica for a couple of years, and they were big on the banana exports. And so I was wondering if maybe we crossed paths down in the Caribbean somewhere, maybe.
Well, possibly. Dominica was one of my islands. I ran the operation out there, which was Dominican Republic in the north, to mm-hmm. Trinidad in the south, with 11 nice. Islands in the middle. So yeah. Most of my work actually was not to do with bananas, because the mainstay of the bananas when I was working for Eastland was lifted in Dominican Republic. But there was also bananas loaded, well, when I first joined, in Dominica, St. Lucia and St. Vincent.
Yep.
St. Vincent and Dominica dropped off, so it was just St. Lucia. And then they would then go up north to Dominican Republic to load up with bananas before they came across the Atlantic. Nice. But just to go back to your point about, you know, where do you want to be, what do you want to do? That's a really good question, because actually, one thing I've always observed in the military is it's actually quite a selfish lifestyle. And I don't mean... And that almost sounds contradictory, right? Because you're in service and you are serving your country. Therefore, that's not a selfish act in any way, shape, or form. But if you want to climb the greasy pole and get to the top, you've got to be quite selfish about it. And some of my friends that made it to and are still in that are up, you know, in high ranking, you know, 1, 2, 3-star positions. I think if they were really, really honest, they would admit to the fact that they've had to be a little bit selfish along the way to get there.
Absolutely.
That's something that I've always really struggled with, is being selfish. Mm-hmm. And probably why I was never going to be a 1-star or a 2-star or a 3-star. And so again, bringing it back into what do you want to do and what you want to be when you're in civvy street after a long and not so illustrious career. Well, I stumbled a little bit because I didn't know, because I was so concerned about, well, what does everybody else want me to be? What should I be to fit into this new life I need to be in?
This box, right? What do I need to go from here to here? What does this box look like?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was only when, and I won't go into the reasons why, but the final sort of straw that broke the camel's back with my marriage, that I actually grew a pair. I thought I had a pair, but I actually grew a pair. To break away, properly break away, and get on with what I needed to do. So I feel now at the age of 53 that I'm really only starting my life properly. And I hope, although I probably drink too much, I hope that my life and my health keeps me going long enough to achieve what I want to achieve. And I know exactly what I want to do. And I will only say that I have finished my work as a distiller in Portsmouth when I get off a plane in the Caribbean and I see a bottle of my rum sitting in the duty free. Then I'm done. And then I find a nice sun lounger and I go and drink that rum, and perhaps I'll have a week, wake up again, job done.
There you go. But you know,
question, sorry, yeah. Because I just want to come step, because we're all, in some senses, we're all professional nomads. Our professional choices have taken us away from home. And this, and I want to get into the entrepreneurialism side whenever you're ready, Scott, but just one thing, because you're both so equipped to answer this. The Navy gave me the most stability that I'd ever had in my whole junior, youth and adult life, right? I'm from a very dysfunctional background. I loved it. It blew my mind until it wanted to form me or define me and take away that creative or entrepreneurial edge, which we all, Vince, you've just talked about it. Scott, one of the key reasons why you and I get on so well. But everything I extracted from that took me overseas and allowed me to survive, basically. Now, coming back to you guys had a uniform. I didn't have the uniform, but you ultimately, after, if you like, 12 years of overseas service, the only real identity that I had left was my British passport. Because people say you're a Brit, and I'd go home to the UK, even with my own family, and I go, oh, I'm not a Brit any longer. I don't know what I am anymore. So I struggled with that because my passport became my identity, like your uniform becomes your identity. It's about the one, and sausages, right? I just loved sausages. It was about the only two things I had left that I'd hold on to. But I'd go overseas and everyone would say, you're a Brit. And I go, well, I'm not a Brit. I look like a Brit and I'm packaged like a Brit, but I don't think I am. So don't measure Britain by who I am as a person. And then I'd get home. And one of the reasons I didn't marry till later on in life, Vince, is because of all the things you guys just articulated. I realized very early on that if there was a system, I would buck it. If there was a bureaucracy, I'd try and find my way around it. And it doesn't help you in most large organizations. And marriage is an institution. It was one of the few things I thought, if I'm going to respect that, then I'm going to have to really know myself as a person before I get involved in it. But going back to the UK, it was very early on, and this is pre-Brexit, by the way, so Brexit isn't a crossroads on this, was I don't belong here anymore. The only thing that connects me to the people here are people of my history. So people like you, Vince, I know we don't talk a lot, we don't get to hang out much, but people who had a positive influence on my past are my sole connection with being part of the UK. But when I go there, any length of time, after the first two or three days, I go, I don't belong here. So what I'm talking about is that psychological transformation when, and I'm sure you've both had it with long deployments, and you go back, and whether you're still in the uniform, you've been away a long time, or once you've gone out the gates and realize, all my perceptions, or a lot of my perceptions are challenged and are wrong, and this sense of belonging disappears. How did you manage it?
Go ahead, Vince.
That's really it's a really interesting concept that I've never actually given it much thought. But hearing you speak about losing your sense of identity and connection, if you're in the service for as long as I was, and you move around every 18 months to 2 years, right? Because that's the nature of the beast. Whether that be a different unit, a different, you know, shore base, or even a country on occasions, you very quickly learn to make the best of the environment you're in, because you have to. You've got no choice. In terms of connection, that's a really, really interesting concept, because I suppose you are connected to the core central aspect of the service, and you likened it to, you know, having a uniform, and I suppose you are. But when you leave, and as we all have, my ability to understand my own identity as I've got older and this sort of transition in this part of my life has become more difficult and less easy to define. And that's not just because I've, you know, recently divorced and my life has changed hugely and all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, 3 years ago started this fantastic idea of a distillery, but I do find that I find a bit more of a disconnect with my own country living in it than I ever have before. And I think that comes down to a yearning of wanting to be somewhere else as much as anything else. Does that make any kind of sense at all? I mean, if you've moved around a lot, and that is a really difficult thing, and in fact, it's probably another key point if we're talking about transition and moving on from being in the service. One of the big things you've got to face, and this is a really big thing, is when you're in the service, you've got the chance to move around, whether you wanted to or not, right? You got put into situations that you wanted to be sometimes you got put into situations you didn't want to be in. But the bottom line was, you knew how shit it was going to change, because that's what happens in the service. Guess what? Spoiler alert, unless you change things as a civilian, they never change. And that can be really, really dull, really dull. And I think if I think you need to really understand that when you leave. And I think that's what I'm talking about with my disconnect with in terms of identity of place, because I have been so lucky to have been so far and so many places in the world that actually I have a real deep-seated fear. And I think it's been accentuated with COVID, right, over the last 18 months, deep-seated fear that I might never get to travel around the world again, you know. And that would be, that'd be like someone, you know, wrenching out my heart, frankly, because, you know, I love to go and experience other cultures and see people. Now, I don't mean, you know, go and sit in a bar somewhere. I mean, go and see countries. So, yeah, I kind of get your point, Angus, really. I don't know if I've answered that or just waffled completely.
What I'll add to it as well is there's a bit of laziness, right? And maybe laziness is the wrong word, or and apathy is better. But, you know, in the military, right, you're forced to move. And again, there's kind of that shoulder shrug, hands up in the air of, I don't have a choice, right? Like, you know, look, this is the uniform that I wear, and they're telling me to go across the country. They're telling me to go to Iraq. They're telling me to, so I have no choice in the whole thing. It's fait accompli, you know, and then that becomes our normal, right? Like, oh, well, I have to move again. And so my kids were laughing because when we came back to the States, they, you know, the Australia housing market is crazy expensive. And we were in Sydney for a while, then Tasmania, then we left out of Melbourne. So we were constantly moving. And, you know, we're looking for our, you know, like a dog, my forever home now, right here in the south side of Nashville, and looking at buying a house and figuring out. And my 18-year-old was laughing and saying, Dad, you know, like, what's the longest that you've lived in one place? And it wasn't very long, so again, spoiler alert, right? But I like that. I like that being mobile. But if I was chained to that identity of being this professional nomad, because, you know, straight out of university, I went from Chicago to New York, and then I went from New York to the Caribbean, then I went from Caribbean to Australia the first time, met my wife, joined the military, was all over the place in the military, right? I mean, from Fort Benning to Fort Bragg to Fort Campbell, you know, then Iraq, Afghanistan, everywhere in between, all that stuff, right? Back to Australia after all of that, from Sydney to Tassie to Melbourne, and then back to the US again, right? Like, I am a nomad at heart, right? Like, I can throw the things in my closet, in my go ruck sacks, and be gone out the door in 2 minutes. And yeah, that was a great place to live. It's fine. But too many of us let that define us, right? That old peace and that old comfort. And again, it's to Vincent's point, it's that fear of change. It's that, you know, change isn't necessarily bad. And do I get scared of buying one house for the rest of my life and calling it my forever home? No, because I'm realistic enough to know that if that house doesn't work, what will we do? We'll buy another house and we'll move, right? I mean, it's not the end of the world, but people are either too open to being locked that identity or too open to not being locked by any identity. In either side of that, right, they're polar opposites. And in either side of that, you've got to find your kind of your azimuth and your way in life and figure out that, yeah, you know, but we think that it's back to the military, right? Like, I'm either on the East Coast or I'm on the West Coast, or I'm here or there, or I'm sailing in between, or I'm deployed and I'm always away from my family. And those are those alpha and omega type operations, right? But in reality, the azimuth just kind of just does this, right? It kind of shifts a little bit. Like, we're in Franklin. We don't want to be in Franklin. We want to be in Brentwood. We don't want to be in Brentwood. We want to be in Thompson Station, right? Those aren't massive changes. And yet far too many of us build up those changes is, well, that's a new school district. That's this, that's that. That's a whole move again. That's moving. That's all these other things. And Vincent said it very early, that fear takes over. And we never learn to combat it rationally. We never learn just to accept it, realize that most failure isn't fatal. We don't have to be fearful of all the changes, that we can adapt and thrive and survive in those new roles if we're just open to the opportunities that are presented to us.
Yeah. Actually, I think the point about fear is just, my biggest fear is generally people who've run on very tight rails for most of their life. And so they cannot or will not look beyond their own thinking, and therefore that's actually the moving piece is that where I live right now on the west coast of the US is, for most Brits, a place you see on TV, not a place you ever go to. So I could track back to that. And so settling and resettling is sort of a thing you do. I'm at an age where I don't like it so much. I like the idea of a forever home. So when I look at you, Scott, in Tennessee, or Vince, you over in in Portsmouth in your fort there. I go, yeah, I get a little bit green-eyed monster, I'll be completely honest, because I still haven't found that where's the forever home, that little thing you always return to.
And people laugh, right? Because we were sitting in Melbourne, and so to paint a better picture, we moved to Australia in 2014, and to go be closer to my wife's family, you know, and her, she's Australian, so her whole family's over there. And I thought that was our forever place, right? That's going to be our continent. I'm moving to Australia. I have my permanent residency. I was going to get my citizenship, right? Like, that is us. That's what we're going to do. And being an American in Australia was an identity. So it's to your point, Angus, of being British, right? But watching the news and realizing, you know, one, I don't think a lot of the expats over there, so this is the point to where I piss off somebody and Angus is going to laugh, right? But the expat American community in Australia are, oh my God, they're horrible for the most part. Like, there are some good people for them, but you get painted by this brush of being this American. Everything on the news, watching from, you know, 2014 to 2020, we moved back, right, was Trump, and it looked like a civil war was going to break out in the States. It looked like there was a race war and all this stuff happening. It looked like the Democrats and Republicans are going to go to, you know, literally a new civil war on that. It was horrific. So I found myself never challenging being American, but even my American persona modified a bit because I was open to the Australian isms out there, right? Like work-life balance. And it used to really drive me insane. We moved to Sydney, and the very first day of my kid's school, I was talking to, you know, the teachers there and the principal, and I'm asking about the workload and all this stuff. And they're like, whoa, Scott, easy. You know, they'll get it. Work-life balance. And every conversation with almost every Australian for the next 7 years was work-life balance, you know. They'll get it, you know, and there was no homework. It's everything's going to work out. And me being that hard-driving, competitive, capitalistic guy, it just didn't ever compute. Well, 7 years later, I'm sitting in Franklin, and I'm going, all right, work-life balance. I can be a business owner, and I can take walks every lunch with my wife, and I can stop work and go to my kids' soccer games, and I can go to universities, you know, and look at them with my older son and pick up my daughter from daycare and take her to the playground. But getting back to the point of, we moved back to Franklin. I meet people here now, south of Nashville, and they go, well, what made you choose Franklin? Did you grow up here? And I said, no, we just, we were sitting in Australia. My wife got a huge promotion for work. And so we had basically the U.S. to pick from. We looked at Seattle and Portland and the Pacific Northwest, and all that Occupy nonsense was going on. So that was a no-go. And then Miami, that didn't want to do that. We looked at the Gulf Shore in Alabama, didn't want to do that. Colorado, where one of our dearest friend Otis is very cold. My wife hates the cold, so that's out. And so we just kind of looked at a map, and I'd never even set foot in Franklin before, and now we're here. And it blows people's minds when I meet them at soccer. They go, why did you choose Franklin? I go, I don't know, why not? We like Nashville, you know, when I was at Fort Campbell, my wife worked at Vanderbilt. Nashville is a good city. We like their COVID response, you know, everything about it. So we just kind of chose it. They go, you moved internationally and just picked a place off of a map recon? I'm like, yeah, pretty much. But again, right, that blows people's minds. To me, that's no big deal. I'm like, what's so weird about that to you? Like, I had to live somewhere. If I got to choose, I chose where we wanted to go. But it's just that whole mental piece. And a lot of that is from me being a special operator and being a combat vet from, you know, overseas, that I know that we can change. I know that something is going to happen, that if we hate it, we just pack up and go somewhere else. It's not going to define us. It's not going to scar my kids. They've moved around enough in life to where they're highly malleable and amazing young men. And my daughter's three, so she's not a fine young woman yet, but I'm hoping she will be one day. So we're getting there, right? But again, it just blows your mind. It's like, you can't take your kids out of school. Why not? We're moving. We're going here.
This is cool, actually. Just so, education to entrepreneurialism. You both come from conservative backgrounds, right? And I mean that with a small c, you know, so, you know, business, military, whatever. And you're both now entrepreneurs, which is you see something and you go, right, I'm going to change this. I'm going to walk the walk on this. Right now, what's the other big thing? I love education. I love intentional learning. And I love one of my surviving mechanisms overseas was driving myself to be better so I could survive the environment I'm in. And then you get addicted to that sort of, oh, I've just discovered more about myself and what I can achieve, right? You both have done the same, both later in life, have sort of, not entirely, but in some way sort of sloughed off that conservative environment, and education is generally conservative in the sense it runs on very tight rails, and going, right, now we're going to be entrepreneurial, and we've got a vision, and we're going to walk the walk on our own leadership skills, our own knowledge. No one's teaching us how to do this. We're just going to jump off the ledge and just do it because we believe we can drive this. And I think, Vince, you're really kind about, you know, tagging something you said earlier with an arrogance label. I think you have to have a little bit of arrogance to be entrepreneurial, but it's not arrogance born of ignorance. It's sort of arrogance born of confidence.
So I think I'll just jump in on that one. Right. The arrogance piece worries me all the time. And it worries me for a number of reasons. The first, we'll link the military side to it first, is especially in the UK, I don't know quite what it's like in the States or other parts of the world, but in the UK, if you've been in the services for as long as I was, then the instant vision that people outside have of you in the workplace or wherever is that you're going to be an arrogant, trumped up military arsehole that wants everyone to do it the way you want it done and nothing else, right? That's the first issue with the word arrogance, right? The other one, which is now the issue, I never really had that problem because I wasn't that kind of person, but you still have to get over that hurdle, right? Because that's what people's mindset is. The one that I find now, and I had it only, when was it? Friday. I did a webinar, a lecture for the Institute of Brewing and Distilling. I was invited to talk about setting up a distillery, which I was very privileged to do. And I remember I was doing my thing. There's presentation and then questions and answers. And I had a little, tiny little out of body experience when I was answering one question. And I thought, shit, are you being a bit arrogant in that answer, Vince? I wasn't. I was being passionate, right? It was passion. And one of the hardest things as an entrepreneur when you built something like we have here, and you know, the products are really from my heart, when you're talking about them and you're answering people's questions, and they're normally, you know, they're very open, nice questions, it's very difficult sometimes. You're walking this tightrope between arrogance and passion, right? Because some people will see your passion as arrogance, and it isn't. It's just passion. And I think that's a really, you know, so arrogance is a horrible word, but I'm often described as being a bit arrogant. I'm not. I'm just highly passionate about it, you know, so I get that.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, when people meet me for the first time, there's almost that, you know, like, well, holy cow, Scott, you're a business owner and a former Green Beret, and you've lived all over the place. And I think my head is about this big, right? That I'm walking around like sideways trying to fit through doors and stuff. And I'm going, those are all just jobs, man. Like, I'm never a guy that lets a job define me. Being a special operator defines me. Angus will tell you, every single day I draw back from something I learned on an A-team in Special Forces, every single day. But just because I have those tools in my backpack to pull from, right, and the passion to solve the problems that I know that the company is solving and doing things, again, it's not arrogance. It's a bit of confidence in what we're doing, but it's all driven off, and this is going to be an arrogant statement to double down on that, right? But it's driven off the fact that I know what we're doing is right. And my passion is in doing more and more of that. And so I have people on my team who, and I am a conservative guy, who are not conservative people. And I, again, another lesson from A-team, right? Surround yourself with people who are better than you and different than you. And I think I've done that very well in the company as well. And sometimes I'll listen to them and I'll let them play their case out and I'll go, nope, that's not how we're doing it. And we're going for it this way. But instead of being an arrogant answer of, nope, you're wrong, I'm right because I'm the boss and I have some titled authority over you, I will explain and educate why we have to do that, to stick to our mission, not to scale too quick, not to do anything, you know, stupid, and it's going to be more problematic for the company. But again, when people meet me, they think I have this massive ego, and I'm like, I don't have an ego at all. I mean, I'm so flawed in everyday operations that sometimes I wonder how my wife and kids put up with me, right? I wonder how Angus puts up with me and Heather, my 2IC in the company. I don't know how she puts up with me because I'm open and raw with her on the business side a lot of times, but it's a confidence in doing and enacting the vision that we've all agreed upon. And I think the arrogance comes from solo entrepreneurs who don't have a team to make them better and who rely only on themselves. And then they start drinking their own Kool-Aid, thinking that they're the best person to ever walk the earth because they made a certain amount of money or because they have a certain number of social media followers. And I'll tell you what, I was at an event last week, Dave Ramsey, you probably don't know him in the UK. I don't know if you do or not. He's globally famous financial coach, and he helps people get out of debt, and he's worth upwards of a couple hundred million dollars personally. And I followed Dave for 20 years, and I was at an event for his last week. And you would think this guy, who is the third largest radio show host in the States, worth millions and millions and millions of dollars, and has got a team of 1,000 around him, and has just risen. He was the most down-to-earth, approachable guy. I mean, he left his studio and was out hugging on his employees, and everybody at that company, from the interns walking you around and giving you tours of the studios and the building, were passionate and purposeful in being there. Every VP that I met, every personality there, I met, everybody there was the exact same way. They were approachable. They were and it was no arrogance at all, but there was a massive amount of confidence in what they do. And in fact, I left that event and I told Angus and Heather, the two people who help run the socials, I said, we got a lot of work to do. And I actually killed a lot of our social feeds that we had pending to go out and revamping it. But there's no arrogance in that statement, right? Like, I saw something that we can do better, and I have the confidence that that aligns with our vision to help us get to the next point. But they had to explain to us, it was called the influencer event. And so to put it in perspective about lack of arrogance, I was sitting at a table during these 3 days, and a guy beside me was a pastor who runs a series of podcasts and helps people get out of debt through all these churches. And he's planted like a dozen churches across the US and all this. And he brought it up and said, I really wish they hadn't named this the influencer event, because I don't feel like an influencer. And I said, yeah, I hate being hypocritical, John. I agree with you. I've openly mocked people who call themselves influencers, as a matter of fact. And so day two, the senior VP, to put a bow on the story, right? A senior VP got up on the stage and said, I've heard a lot of speculation in this room of 60 plus people about why we call it the influencer event. And there's a lot of resistance from you guys is saying you're influencers, but we don't count your social media followers. We don't count what you do or how much money you have in the bank. You're an influencer because in your field, after we've looked at you for a year plus, people listen to what you have to say. And I went, and it kind of blew my mind, right? Because I had been on I'm not an influencer. I don't have that many social media followers. I don't want that many social media followers. I certainly don't have the brand that I want just yet. And yet I now have the confidence on the backside of that to go, they were right. And so it's being arrogant and enacting your vision, and it's having the confidence to take those steps necessary to do the things like you're doing, Vince, right? Like to wait 3 years to release your rum, to speak at these events and to do things and have that tactical patience to deliver a product that you know is coming down, that your passion and your soul have been poured into.
That's really funny. And Vince, I want to ask you a couple of things off the back of that. I remember being in China and speaking to audiences of 500 in Chinese. And I'd say, like, one time I was talking to the British Chamber of Commerce rep, and they asked me to sit at top table with an Olympic athlete, Sir Steve Redgrave. And I went, but I'm a nobody. Why do you want me up there? These are top table, you know, $100, $200 ticket plates. And they went, you're the only person we know who can speak Chinese well enough to interact between the UK athlete and the Chinese athlete. I went, no way. I said, look at all the brands in the room here. Are you telling me there's no way? And they went, no. And I said, well, are you going to piss off a lot of people by letting me sit there? And they said, yeah, but we'll piss off a lot more people by not letting you sit. I went, fine. I'll take the ticket. I'm happy, man. And it's so much fun. But Vince, coming back to your comment there and then thinking about what you're doing and something you said to us earlier around, you're big on rum, but to get to the rum, you've got to deliver on the gin, right? And then on this journey now, suddenly you're speaking to the Institute of Brewers and Distillers. So let's share some discovery in your new entrepreneurial world. What were some of your top two or three learnings in moments of discovery where you have these out, you said out of body. I'm sitting here and go, this isn't arrogance, this is passion. And I love it. I love speaking to you both because I feel very passionate about certain things. And also I find myself winding my neck in regularly because I'm a big human being. And sometimes my passion gets mistaken for being an overwhelming individual. And but in terms of the entrepreneurial side, Vince, let's explore some of those discoveries and how did you manage around them?
Well, I think another word, and we're not just playing bingo word, you know, wank word bingo here, but, you know, modesty is another real, I think, important thing in the success of you know, building a brand and you know, entrepreneurialism, because you know, you can be passionate about something, but you should also be a bit modest. And that's where you're coming in when you're saying about, you know, what do you want me to sit on the top table for? Who am I? I'm a nobody. Well, I consider myself in that league as well. I really do. I'm very modest about what we're doing here, but I'm also very passionate about it. In terms of building the brand, in terms of, you know, how do we set it up? What was the plan? Well, we started off, I guess, like a lot of people do in this particular business, thinking, well, we've got to get an angel. We've got to get an angel investor because this is going to cost us north of £350,000 to set up a distillery, you know, because we costed it all out. Oh, I'm thinking, shit, you know, we're never going to afford this. It's never going to happen. I was starting to get a little bit, I was getting agitated. I was getting nervous. Go back to the first, you know, earlier point, you know, because I'd been made redundant. I had no vision of what I wanted to do again. So I found myself 5 years back again, leaving the Navy. And the last thing I wanted to do, because of the lessons I'd learned working in Geestein, was to work for someone else, right? I wanted to do my own thing and flex those wings. So we were very lucky that on the first attempts to get someone to invest and therefore inject a huge amount of cash and make it easy for us, we fell on our asses, right? We couldn't find anybody. And that was the best thing that happened to us because we then had to turn again, you know, and my business partner is an ex-military as well. So we had to, you know, we had to turn to our resilience. We had to turn to our resources. We had to work out what it is, right? Okay, we're still in this campaign. We still got to get to the end goal. How are we going to do it? So we worked out some different courses of action and we went through it in a sort of, you know, almost a military assessment of how to get stuff done. And then we decided, right, let's do this step by step by step, as you would do if you're in some kind of military campaign, right? You hit, and to use a civvy analogy as opposed to military, fighting the nearest alligator to the canoe, right? And that's what we were doing with the step by step by step. So how much do we need to get to this next step? Well, we need this much. Well, how much have we actually got in the pot? Well, not a great lot, a great deal. Well, where can we get some money from? Okay, well, let's do a bit of remortgaging, right? Do that. That's enough to get this stage. And we just went enough to get our still. And when we got the equipment, then, and enough money to buy the first turn of the handle to make the first amount of gin, the first amount of rum, right? And then the gin was there to start bringing in the revenue to be able to walk a bit faster and create a bit more and then do more rum. And da, da, da. So we started off in November 2018 with Fort Gin, which is still our best seller because it's a gin and people love gin and it's a good gin. Double award winning. Look it up. It's awesome. So we got that going, which was keeping the lights on. And that was building and building and building. But then we sort of had this, you know, look, well, we've got to sell this. How are we going to sell it? Right, we need someone in to sell it. So you bring that in. And all the while, you go one step forward and maybe two or three back, and then you go four forward and then one or two back. And that's, you just, and you have to be ready to do that if you're going to make something that's worth making and if you're going to have something that's worth having. Because if we got that investor that had gone, there you go, Vince, there's a check for £350,000, would I still be here? I don't know that I would. Because all of those deep inbred lessons and abilities that one had drilled into me, you know, I mean, I went to boarding school from the age of 10, so I'm a relatively resilient guy, okay? And then the military for nearly 26 years. I wouldn't have had to have drawn on those. It would have been easy street. So if you get Easy Street, you don't work as hard. If you don't work as hard, you don't produce as well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're very lucky that some of our failures, if you like, and it wasn't a failure, but it felt like it at the time, has given us the resilience to build higher. Now, one thing I will say, and this is really right down to a really incredibly easy example for everybody to understand. You don't have to be an entrepreneur to understand this, or ex-military or business person or anything, right? Outside of our distillery, we've got quite a large space, which since COVID, we've decided we really need to start using and utilizing for revenue generation, right? It's big enough for two, it's big enough for three, but we currently got two 12 meter by 9 meter marquees. So we erected 12 meter by 9 meter marquees. And being, you know, naval and knowing how to tie these things down and all that, did all, everything correct and all the rest of it. Anyway, there was a freak storm in the UK about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks now. It wasn't so much a storm, but for the first time in this part of the world, we had a you know, there was a twisting element to the wind, which you just don't see in the UK. And as we all know, those have been in the tropics, it's not the speed of the wind that does the damage, it's the twist in the wind that does the damage, right? Whether it be a proper twister or whether it's a hurricane, you know, in that part of the world where the Coriolis effect takes more charge, blah, blah, blah. So on the Saturday night, this came through. I was lying here in my one bedroom flat, and I'm two floors up, so I could hear the wind, and I was starting to get a bit agitated, thinking, oh, what do I do? Should I go down there? Should I go down? Anyway, I ended up getting up at like 6:30 and running down there because I was so worried. Not that I could have done anything. And I walked around the corner, and our two marquees were shagged, flat, decimated. And I looked at it, and I went, I didn't know what to do. At first, I wanted to cry, but that's not going to get you anywhere. And then I sort of looked at it and thought, well, I'll clear it up. Well, I can't clear it up on my own. The wind was still blowing too hard anyway. And if I tried to do something, I probably would end up getting myself hurt, right? So I stepped back and I had a look, and I got hold of my two business partners and said, you know, showed them some photographs, said, look, you know, this is where we're at. And Giles, the other ex-military, said, look, you know, just step away from it today because there's nothing we can do today. It looks like a, you know, bag of shit. We'll assess it on Monday. So I came home, was, you know, I was a bit upset about it, didn't really know. I was worried. Anyway, went back in the morning, fresh eyes, fresh perspective. We tore it all apart, put it in piles of what could be used, what couldn't be used, what needed to be repaired, what didn't need to be repaired. We had a few spares anyway. And you know what? Week and a half later, we had two marquees back up again. That was resilience. That was hard work. That was, right, we need to patch this because there's a rip here. We need to straighten that, knock, knock, knock. We need to, you know, all these things. Now, if I had had a check for £350,000 right at the very beginning, those marquees wouldn't have meant a dot to me. I'd have just gone, sod it, just buy two more marquees, right? But that's not what we do. Those, if you can see behind me, anyone, you know, you guys, you two guys can, those racks, those wooden racks upon which the barrels lay, that's Giles. He builds those. We don't get people in to do it for us. You know, it's all about really, you know, because we could, we've got the money to get someone in to do it. But why would you do that? You know, you spend your money on, you save your money for things you need down the line. I said to Angus before we came on air, you know, I'm 53 years old. I'm earning less now than I've earned since I was 26 years old. A lot less. You know, when I was working at Geestline, I was six-figure salary, lovely, wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Now I earn a lot, lot less than that. And I'm the happiest I've ever been. Because what I build, I build. What I have, I have. You know, and it's important to me. And it's not important to the point where I won't share it with people. Of course it isn't. But important that, you know, I think you really need, it's resilience, isn't it? I think is what I'm trying to say. That's one of the key points to being a good entrepreneur. Modesty, humility, resilience, and a really, really good work ethic. Because you haven't got a work ethic, then forget about it, because you're going to be working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day in the first year of your business, I think, if you want to make anything for it.
Angus and I are running, we have a project management course for young professionals. And, you know, we all know the saying, right? How do you eat an elephant? Right. You know, and so we brought it up to these high school, American high schoolers in this course. And I said, you know, because they were talking about these projects being so big. And this is what reminded me when you're talking about, you know, your 350,000 pound investment, right? These, everything was just so big. And I said, well, guys, how do you eat an elephant? And this one kid gets real big eyes on the Zoom call. And he looks at me, and he goes, Mr. Scott, is it alive? And I went, you guys don't know this saying, how do you eat an elephant, right? But I said, you ask your Green Beret, how do you eat an elephant? I've already got my knife and fork out. And I'm like, do I start in the trunk? Do I start in the foot? Do I start on the hind quarter? Like, I'm already diving in and chewing, right? Like, I'm going to adapt and figure out, like, what I want to do better in the future. But it's those same principle of starting a business, right? If I would have said, my goal is to certify 12,000 people in 2021, I wouldn't have known how to go about and doing it, right? And instead, we just baby stepped the launch and we certified 12,000 people this year, or trained 12,000 people. A couple thousand need to do some makeup sessions, et cetera, et cetera. But we just launched a course middle of November that I've had as a brainchild for 3 years. And it's a video on demand project manager certification course. And I talked about it before I ever started my own company when I was at the Institute of Project Management. And we all knew it was a great idea, but didn't have the time and the resources. I talked about it when I started the company. We didn't have the reach. And now we've launched it and we're getting great reviews on it. And Angus was instrumental in getting the whole thing up and going as well. But it was something for 2.5 of those 3 years, I had to keep putting pins in because it wasn't the right time. And now, if you know me at all and anybody listening to this, I hate putting pins in things. Like the special operator in me, if there's something that has to be done, I'm going to go do it right now and then get it done, right? Like as much as Heather will bash me for having tasks on my to-do list that aren't done yet, I really do like getting things done and not having them hanging over my head. And so putting pins in things is not in my heart at all. But again, that resilience, that learning as I built this whole thing up is that great idea, Angus, not the right time. Awesome idea. Let's do it in 3 months. Or awesome idea, we don't have the ability to do it because I'm kind of famous within the team for saying, I don't want success to kill us. Meaning that if we would have gone viral with some of our project management courses, instead of going viral in January of 2021, which happened, and we're putting 1,000 people in a course at a time, if it would have happened in November, December, we wouldn't be around because our systems weren't there. Our people weren't there. We had the wrong people in some roles and in a lot of other stuff, but it's by staying the course and being deliberate and resilient in what we knew was right. Again, not arrogance, but passion and vision, right? Like, and again, I'm not, it makes me feel like, what type of asshole do you sound like, Scott, saying your vision out loud, right? Like you're not Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or whatever, but I know what right looks like on this thing. And you know why? Because to your point, Vincent, I've obsessed over it every single day. I go to sleep thinking about it. I wake up thinking about it. I think about it when I have my cigars and my walks with my wife. I think about it when my son's playing soccer. I think about it all the time. And I'm trying to figure out fine-tuning ways to make this thing better and more sustainable. That's the passion that a lot of people don't have. And without that, they're doomed for failure.
I have another word since we are playing wank word bingo.
Yes.
And it's very, very key to what you've just said there. And that's patience. And I am probably the least patient man on this planet, right? I took up oil painting after I had a spinal operation in 2003, to learn patience. This is an arrogant statement, I suppose. I don't know, is it? I don't know, but I'm very good at oil paintings and I sell them and all the rest of it, but blah, 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 when I get the time. But I did it because you have to be patient with oil painting because you've got to do a layer, then come back to it and all that kind of malarkey, right? I'm still no more patient, even though I've been doing, you know, been painting for all these years. To give you an example in my business with patience, where actually, I am learning it slowly but surely. Waitrose, right? One of the premium supermarkets here in the UK. It would say it is the premium supermarket, I guess. It's the one that all the wealthier people shop at, I guess. Is that true? Anyway, whatever. We courted them right at the very beginning because the head wines and spirits buyer, a guy called John Vine. We'd met a couple of years before when we were doing the sort of the business model of whether we, you know, whether we could make a distillery work, right? And he spoke at a conference, and he said that in his opinion, bearing in mind he's the guy that says the yes or no for buying spirits for Waitrose, he said that there was room on the shelves in his supermarket for an artisan white rum. Okay, so tick, let's go for it. So we went off and we made our first gin in November 18, and then our first rum in December 18. And then I think we'd managed to track this guy down by about August 19. And we pitched up at his place on his desk with three spirits. So there you go. So we've got a spice rum, a white rum, and our gin. There you go, John. You said there was space for an artisan. This is a bloody good artisan white rum. Let's have it on the shelves. Well, some considerable of period of time later, and we're now in April, and tail end of April 2021, we finally got our Fort Gin into six local stores, right? So it's still not the white rum. So Mr. Impatient Bastard still giving it, well, why is the white rum not on the shelf? But it's the long game, right? At the end of the day, we are now retailed by one of the leading supermarkets in the UK. It's not the product I want, but it's there. So you just got to let things go. And it's one of the hardest things for me. And I think it's an inherent trait of entrepreneurs to be impatient. And I think you have to be a certain amount of impatience to get shit done, right? Because otherwise you just hang around and smoke and who gives a damn. You've got to be in the right measured amount of patience versus impatience. And I don't profess to get anywhere close to that. And I probably never will. And I think so long as one of the directors is impatient in your company, then you're all right, because someone's going to be kicking the doors and making the noise all the time. And that tends to be me in our company.
Yeah, no, same here. Heather has unlimited patience, and it runs out whenever I start talking, and she starts, I call it her cobra weave. She'll do this all the time. And that's like her code, like, Scott, shut up, you know? And I just lend everything to Heather. Now, if we need patience in something, or a trainer has an issue and it's gotta be developed, like, hey, go talk to Heather. There you go. You got it. Because, sometimes to me, you know, to a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, right? So, yeah, man.
And let's talk about discipline versus creativity, because you can't both said this, and well done for saying it, but without a vision, you can't be an entrepreneur. You've got to have some creativity. You've got to be able to play with system, process system, and then the discipline to follow through on that. So to your point, Vince, is, and I've heard you twice in this conversation, I wanted to do rum, but I had to do the gin to keep the lights on to get to the rum. I wanted to the rum to go in the store, but now the gin's in the store. And I'm Scott, you've probably been, well, you have been, because you mentioned the same thing. We wanted to do go online, but we had to find out the right product to get out online at the right
time. When I started Deal Well Coach, I thought it would be financial coaching with a side of project management. Instead, it's Vincent, right? Like, I thought financial coaching, my rum, he thought, you know, and instead it's 99% project management training, and I get to do boutique financial coaching whenever I want to. So 100%, it resonates so well with me what you said, Vincent, the same thing.
I think people with a creative vision don't always have discipline, and some of the impatience is part of the expression of just that creative vision, because there's a lot of people out there with no vision. I'm coming right back to the beginning on the transition piece. When we say about, well, what's your vision? Where do you want to be in the world? Is that really a question I have to answer? Well, yes, it is actually. So, and you, again, coming back to this thing about, and Scott, you know, it was you and Otis the other week about myth busting around military people, right? Right. Everyone's perceived to be a certain thing, like super disciplined, steely warriors, but that doesn't necessarily lend itself to creative and thinking or creative strategy or the development of a vision. So how do you manage that continuum?
Well, we've mentioned it. I think we've covered it pretty much already anyway. And I think through some of the things Scott said about, you know, surrounding yourself with good people and you know, always trying to aspire to be as good as they are and all that kind of stuff. With me, again, I go back to, you know, in this wonderful game of, I don't know, abuses you wank word bingo. I alluded to it earlier with the accidental sort of piece, the word accident. Well, was it an accident or by design? It was accidental that we decided to set up a business together, myself and Giles, the first iteration, the Rum Club. But it wasn't accidental that we decided to start a proper business together, because we're the yin and the yang. I'm the impatient bastard that's creative. You know, I'm the gobby creative one, I'm often described as, because I'm the one who'll stand in front of 50,000 people and sell the product like that because I love it so much. He's the backroom boy that builds racks to put casks on, to build bars, that does all the VAT returns, does all the boring paperwork. But you got to have your yin and the yang. And so we married together so well in business sense, because, you know, there's no way if I was on my own, I'd be anywhere close to where I am now in this business, because I can't be fagged with all that paperwork and stuff. It's not me. But I can get in the, you know, get in the lab and mix up a new rum, or, you know, I've got probably another 4 or 5 products in my head just waiting there, you know, and I can then look at, well, how does it get produced, and what do I need to produce it? What tanks do I need? Where can I put it? How would I pump it? Where would I hold it? All this kind of stuff. So it really works very well. That's how we've done it anyway. If I was on my own, well, forget about it. I wouldn't be here now, certainly.
No, I agree. I was laughing so much during that, I forgot where I was going with it. I mean, in Wink Word Bingo and throwing out Paradigm Shift and Bandwidth and some other stuff just so we cover all the bases, right? But I mean, I think a large part of it as well is knowing your constraints, right? Like knowing what you have. Like, I will not be constrained by debt of any type. You know, I won't take it on. I won't even consider it. And a lot of my part, you know, when we want to buy a new system, we want to do this, we want to do that, or grow somehow, or put somebody on a salary. And, you know, we're in desperate need of a tech person, a full-time tech person at DOL, my company. And I'm like, not yet. We've got enough, you know, within me to keep fixing the website and keep doing stuff and keep building things up and keep doing it, because I don't want to take on somebody who I might have to let go because, you know, something goes south and we can't pay him or her or whatever, right? So I think it's staying true to your course, but also understanding, you know, it's a very project management term, right? But the constraints that bind you as far as what you're doing. And I have no doubt after listening to Vincent that in 5 years, 3 years, 1 year, 5 months, whatever, he's going to have those 3, 4, 5, 6 new products out and going, right? And expand. But it's that tactical patience, right? And there's another military term, right? It's having the ability to go, great idea, not right now. Great idea for the future after this happens. And, you know, and again, I go to everybody. Angus, I've done this to you probably half a dozen or a dozen times, right? Like, hey, Angus, I have this idea. I can't reach out to anybody. Heather's in a meeting. My wife's in a meeting. So I've just got to vocalize this idea to hear what your thoughts of it. And 9 times out of 10, Angus will be like, that's not really the strong idea you think it is, Scott. Or, yeah, but. And if I was that egotistical, narcissistic asshole, only limited by my vision, right, I would go, well, screw you, Angus. This is my idea, and I no longer want your input, right? But I take it on, I go have another cigar, I think about it, and that plan morphs, and then my true north finally happens, and we launch an infinitely better product because I had the modesty to actually go to somebody and say, here it is, it's not perfect. The last perfect person walked the earth like 2,000 years ago, right? So I'm nowhere near that. And it's just having that ability and that trust in the people that you are. And there's a word we haven't thrown out yet, is entrusting Giles and entrusting Angus and Heather and everybody that we do have, and knowing that those things will get done because of that shared trust and responsibility that we have together.
Yeah, and that actually, to wrap it up, I guess, from military to civilian and entrepreneur and all the rest of it, the word trust is one thing that people say to me, what do you miss about the military? You know, what was the hardest thing? What is it that you miss? Well, I don't miss a great deal, if I'm absolutely honest. I miss the people to a certain extent, but not all of them, because some of them were arseholes. But, you know, I'm sure some of them thought I was. But, hey, there you go. I miss the T word, trust. because inherently, whether you thought that guy or girl was an arsehole, you still trusted her or him, and she you. Because you build your entire life on trust, right? Because in any given situation, that person could be the person that saves you or you them. That's not the case in Civvy Street. In Civvy Street, the T word hopefully is there, and maybe you can foster it, maybe you can nurture it, maybe it's one of our reasons for being in Civvy Street after a military career is to instill and bring people on with trust. But it's not intuitive, not like it is with us service people in any way, shape or form. And I find that one of the hardest things, because, you know, if I say to someone, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, I'm there and I'm X, Y, Z and it happens, unless I absolutely can't do it. And then I stump up and say, I couldn't do that because of this reason. Right. No, that doesn't happen in Civvy Street. They all crawl under rocks and hide and lie and, you know, blame someone else. And I find that really difficult, because at the end of the day, we all get it wrong. We all get it right. You should be as willing to stand up and take an accolade as you are to take a bollocking, right? And as far as I'm concerned.
Amen. And I've had this conversation with about 36 or more transitioning military special operators. And I'll go, they go, what should I look out for in Civvy Street, right? What's the number one thing that I'm not going to like? And I'll go, one word, agendas. People will have an agenda and they won't tell you what it is, and they'll deny it and they'll lie about it. They'll hide it. They'll do everything they can to not say what, but inwardly you'll figure out in a nanosecond that they have an agenda, and there won't be any trust because of that. Right. And so when I talk to civilians now, I will go so far as you're an intel guy. Right. So I was like, I'll show palms. I'll do all my thing. I go, I don't have an agenda here at all. I'm not a salesperson. I'm a pretty crap salesperson if you ask anybody, because I'm too honest and blunt about what I can help them or not. But I will say I have no agenda here at all. The only agenda I have is in helping this community, transitioning military or corporations doing projects wrong, whatever, do it better. And so that they can satisfy that. Everything that I have is in that proposal, right? There's no hidden fees. There's no nonsense. There's no whatever. There's no agenda there at all. You get what you ask for, and that's, you get more than what you ask for, but you can trust in me because I don't have an agenda 9 times out of 10.
And you know, that's
absolutely.
So, you know, the pair of you, I'd Scott, you and I, in the early days when we started getting together professionally, and you know, one of the things I remember saying to you is just want to be around someone I can trust, right? And it's particularly when you work in a COVID world and everyone's working off Zoom, you know, the trust becomes so important. To your point, Vince, I remember when I first went to China, and you know, was it you I was having this discussion with earlier or someone else? So I gravitated towards military people in China, and I was in some really robust locations because of that thing, right? I don't have to like these people, but we could still share a beer together. But I trusted them, because when I left the military and I'd go into situations. And I did to get myself through college, I did some private security work. You know, even the people who had put me on contracts, they paid me good money. I go, yeah, but what's the actual risk? What am I walking into? Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. Right. And one in two of those situations was not a don't worry about it. You'll be fine. Right. Some of them I was going like, oh, my goodness, talking about it now, I can feel the hairs on the back of my neck coming up. But that thing about trust is so embedded in people in the military. And I would do things with military folks that I would never do with civvies, just because I trust the fact that they've been trained and they respect boundaries, but also show you how to push boundaries and won't put you in danger or risk your situation because of some stupid ego. And when I managed to get a break out of China, go on holiday to Oz, West Oz, and went to do a bit of diving. And again, it was the same thing. My mate Fess, he was a military diver, and we went out off his fishing boat. And I said, Fess, I haven't dived for a while. He went, doesn't matter. Here's the rig. You run through all the checks, takes about 35 seconds. And he said, just get in the water. And he was a chief warrant officer. He was a warrant officer from Aussie SAS. And he goes, don't worry about it. You'll be fine. But with anyone else, I would have not got in the water with him. Because I just know trust in that integrity, that all those things went straight off the side in shark-infested waters, just based on trust. And I would have never done that with a civvy, ever. So we're getting close to time, and I know, because I know I could stay on here for another hour at least, but Vince, you're at the end of your working day. Scott, you're in the sort of the middle of your working day. So let's close out on a positive around entrepreneurialism, because we won't work bingo. We've thrown out a lot of cliches and buzzwords. Entrepreneurialism, and I love the thing that not working for someone else is a key driver behind being an entrepreneur and driving your own vision. At this moment in time, despite all the problems, all the hazards, all the risks, COVID coming out of left field and all this banana, what's your one thought you'd like to leave everyone with on a high about entrepreneurialism? Practical entrepreneurialism.
I think we've got to go back to the passion piece and the love of what you do. And being true to yourself, because you know, we can all come up with big ideas, we can all come up with big concepts, and we can try and drive them through. But if you're not really behind it, if you're not really sold into it, if it's not part of you, then I don't think the business will fly as well as it should. Now, I said earlier that I'm often described in the company as the, you know, the gobby creative one. And the reason for that is, guess what? I'm the gobby creative one. And you know, it really is. And whether my business partners may disagree with me, might even get slightly offended, but it's my baby. I came up with this. This is my idea. Without me, there would be no Portsmouth Distillery, because I came up with the idea. Now, it doesn't mean I'm the only one that's done any work. It doesn't mean I'm the only one that's been good at what we do. It doesn't mean I'm the only one that's done anything. Quite the contrary. As I said before, without everybody else, I wouldn't be here. It's a team effort. But I drive it because of my love of the product and the love of where I want it to be and the love of what I want to achieve with it. And I think that's what I would like to give us the sort of the final thing about entrepreneurialism. I don't think you can do it if your idea or your vision is hollow, because if you do, you might as well work for someone else, right? You might as well just put on a suit and get on a train and say, yes, sir, no, sir, because otherwise, what's the point? It's too difficult. It's too there are too many poo traps. It's too hard sometimes to not have a real passion and a driven love behind what it is you do. And that's what I do. That's what we do here at the Portsmouth Distillery, which is why we're in, you know, 3 years down the line, we just celebrated our third birthday. We've had 18 months of that doing next to cock all because of COVID, right? But we're still here and we're still fighting and we're still in a position to grow. And that's because of the love and the passion and the real authenticity behind it. If you don't have the authenticity, forget about it. Go work for someone else.
Yeah. Well said. The only thing I'll add to that is, you know, is it is a cliche, but when you're doing what you love, you're not working, right? You never work a day in your life when you do what you love. And being an entrepreneur, enacting your vision, doing all the things that you know you should be doing, truly makes it, it's not work. It's just a passion project, and it makes it fun. And when those hurdles come your way, and trust me, to Vince's point, they will, right? When things come out of the left field and right field and the poo is flinging at you everywhere, if you're not dedicated to doing it, it's going to get too hard and you'll quit. Or you'll start dialing it back and you'll just be another. It's the same reason there's a veteran nonprofit around the globe springing up every 10 seconds. And now they're all going out of business in a COVID environment because they all wanted to make their own little niche thing. And it was a passion project, but they didn't want to work for it. They just wanted to feel good. I have a veteran nonprofit. And now they're all going bust. And the true ones that have a passion to them and a purpose behind them are actually coming through. It's the same thing with your company. If you have the belief in it and the vision, it won't be work. It's just fun. And I have a lot of fun. To Vince's point earlier, I've never made less in my professional life outside of the military than I do right now, but I've never been happier. And I've never been as keen to get stuff done as I am now, because I know that there's a bigger piece out there as well.
100%. Gents, thank you so much. Been great having you on. Two hyper buzzing entrepreneurs. I learned a lot about this today. And Vincent, we love to have you on maybe sometime next year just to see how you're getting on with the, and maybe talk more about the distilling side and the business side, but the podcast is evolving and we'd love to have you on board if you're willing after Christmas sometime.
We need a lot more Dobby creative types.
Yeah. And anytime you like, I'm more than happy to sit and talk passionately about what I do. Absolutely. And learn from you guys as well, because I don't have all the answers. So don't.
My cousin's in Scotland. He's a former British EOD guy in the army. So I'm going to have to tell him where to go buy all your stuff. And he'll probably be, he's a bit of an alky. So he'll probably be your biggest new customer. So as being a British bomb guy would make you, I imagine. So so he'll be your new biggest customer.
Yeah, cool. Excellent. All right.